So we begin Bishat Tova this evening, our 22nd season of the Monday Night Shiur. And you may not be surprised to hear that there is yet quite a bit to discuss in the Torah. And we begin at the beginning, well, that is to say, the beginning of Noach. Parshas Bereishis happened rather suddenly this year, but Noach itself begins with Noach, as the Pasuk states. Eile told us Noach. These are the generations of Noach. Noach, tzaddik, tomim hayu b'derosav. Noach is a perfect tzaddik. Es ha'lekim salach Noach. Noach walks with Hashem. And Rashi comments on the very beginning. Eile told us Noach. Noach ish tzaddik. And Rashi states, we'll see his words, and then we'll try and get a sense of where Rashi is coming from and what it is that he's responding to. Says Rashi, Hoel v'hizkiro, having mentioned him, having mentioned Noach, Siper b'shvacho, the Torah speaks in his praise. Eile told us Noach, which mentions Noach, and then speaks in praise of Noach. Noach ish tzaddik. Shene'emar, as the Pasuk states, Zeche Tzadik Libracha. Okay, you mentioned a Tzadik, should say words of Bracha. Dabar Acher, alternatively, a second paper says Rashi, Lelamedcha, it comes to teach you, She'ikar Toldoseim Shel Tzadikim Ma'asim Tovim, that the primary children or offspring or product of Tzadikim are their good deeds. So Rashi has made two comments. The first comment is that the Torah, having mentioned Noah, speaks in praise of him. The second comment is it teaches you that actually a person's good deeds, or more accurately, a tzaddik's good deeds, are their toldos. So having seen Rashi's words, we need to work backwards and ask the question, I mean, why does Rashi say two things, why does Rashi say anything? I mean, the pasuk itself seems to be harmless unless proven otherwise. But of course, the issue that Rashi is responding to is the fact that the Torah seems to have introduced Noah and then immediately gone off on a tangent. No sooner did it say Eile told us Noah, and told us Noah are the sons of Noah, that is the primary understanding of what the word told us means, his generations, meaning his sons, his progeny, it then starts talking about Noah. So the Pasuk isn't moving in a straight line, so to speak. And Rashi wants to know, what are we to make of this digression, it seems, or interruption? Well, if that is the question, then we now need to find out what is the answer. If the problem is that the Torah seems to have interrupted, so how can this be explained? And here Rashi gives two perushim, and not only are they different explanations, there are different kinds of explanations. In other words, they differ fundamentally in approach to the question. For one of them recognizes the question, and the other one does not. And by that we mean, Rashi's first perush is, Hoel b'hizkiro sipe b'shpocho, having mentioned Noach, the Torah speaks in his praise. That's a value. That's a Torah concept. That's called Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and that's Rashi's first perush. And if we would quantify this first perush, we would say that if the question was, there has been an interruption, will you please explain? The answer is, yes, there has been an interruption, and yes, I will explain. The reason why there was an interruption is because of Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Rashi's second perush differs fundamentally from the first, because the second perush, it teaches you that the Ikert told the same of Tzadikim, or the Masim Tovim, according to this approach, there was no interruption. There was no digression. It's a progression. Eile told us Noach is the fact that Noach is a tzaddik. It literally leads into those words. The first grade leads to the second, and that is Rashi's second perush. So they're quite different from each other in approach, these two perush. The question that we need to ask, however, is, why does Rashi see fit to bring this second perush? Once we've seen the issue Rashi's dealing with and the two approaches, the first approach would seem to be quite respectable, and moreover, it is faithful to to Rashi's general understanding that the word toldos really does mean children. I mean, that's the Pashtus. When you see toldos, you think children, and correctly so. You don't think masim tovim. It needs to redefine things for us. So why is it necessary to stay with the first Perush? As we know, however, whenever Rashi gives or presents two Perushim, a second Perush, there's something about the first Perush that was not entirely satisfactory to Rashi. And the question here will be, what is not satisfactory completely for Rashi in the first Perush? Well, this question is addressed by the foremost of the Mefarshei Rashi, the Mizrahi, and after him many others. But Rabbeinu Eliyahu Mizrahi says that the first Perush, it answers the question, but it brings with it other questions. For if we say that the value here and the reason behind the interruption is, having mentioned Noach, the Torah speaks in his praise, and that's the point, so then the moral of the story is, when you mention the tzaddik, you speak in his praise. In this case, Noach. The problem is, Noach has already been mentioned in the Torah. It's a bit of a secret, because it's in the end of Parshas Bereishis, but he has defined a few psukim, and Noach, and even, in fact, his children are even mentioned in the end of Bereishis, which means if the idea here is that no sooner have you mentioned a tzaddik that you speak about the fact that he is a tzaddik, well, we've mentioned him already. This is the second mentioning. So we seem to have let the first opportunity go. Of course, the answer presumably is along the lines that you cannot compare the mention of Noach in the end of Bereishis, which is more leading into Noach, but Parshas Noach is his very own Parsha, and therefore that's where we'll elaborate more on Noach, but that's already, it's not as glut in that sense. So that's the Mizrahi's point. Zecher Tzadik Levracha, he's already been mentioned. Where's the bracha earlier on? Secondly, as Maharal points out, although he does deal with it, as soon as you mention this principle of Zecher Tzadik Levracha, the idea is that when you mention a tzaddik, you speak in his praise. Well, there's many tzaddikim in the Torah, but we don't find many instances of this idea that having mentioned a tzaddik, the Torah speaks in his praise. One would consistently expect that as soon as the Torah mentions Avram, it will speak in his praise. And when it mentions Yitzhak and Yaakov and Yosef and the Shvatim and Moshe and Aaron and we don't find that as a rule, which means if it is a rule, how come it's only active in exceptional cases? These are all pertinent points. But there is another point. It's interesting to note that the question of Zecher Tzadik Levracha is actually discussed, and the source in the Torah for Zecher Tzadik Levracha is discussed in the Gemara. It's in Maseches Yuma and Daf Lamed Ches. And there are two rabbis in the Gemara, and one says to the other, what's the source of the idea of Zecher Tzadik Levracha? Where does it come from? Well, the second rabbi answered, it's a pasuk in Mishlei, which it is. Zecher Tzadik Levracha, B'Shem Risho Em Yirka. So that's more or less straightforward. In fact, it's one of those cases that if only we were there, we know the answer. It's a pasuk, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. But it's not so straightforward, because the first rabbi says, yes, I know it's a pasuk in Mishlei, but my question is, where is it in the Torah? And before we get to the answer, I believe it's most worthwhile just to pause for a moment and ponder this question. Because again, the flow was, where is Zecher Tzadik Levracha from? It's a pasuk in Mishlei. But where is it in the Torah? So let's ask a Balabatish a question. If you don't know where it is in the Torah, then how do you know it's there? Maybe it's not there. As surely as you don't know where it is anywhere else. Maybe it's just not there. What we see from this follow-up question is a most profound, fundamental concept. And that is, it must be there. It's not conceivable that it's a pasuk that is written in Ksuvim that cannot be seen somewhere in the Torah. That's the moral of the story. I don't know where it is, but I know it's there. Why? Because it must be there. If it's in Ksuvim explicitly, it must be in the Torah implicitly. And interestingly, I think it's fair to say that we can learn more from the Gemara's question than we can from the answer, because the answer will be wherever this particular case was. And we'll get to that soon. But the question is, in all cases, it must be thus. Anything in Ksuvim, anything in Nevi'im, in Ksuvim, it's got to be in the Torah. And this expresses from the Gemara an idea that that essentially the role of Nevi'im and Ksuvim is to express and to explicate concepts that are implicit in the Torah. That's the role. And if that's true, then you know by definition, anything that's a pasuk in Nevi'im and Ksuvim, you must be able to find it in the Torah. Otherwise, it wouldn't be explicit in the Nevi'im and Ksuvim. And this is a concept which is found elsewhere as well. The Gemara says in Maseches Tanis on Daf Tes that Rabbi Yochanan, he once came across his nephew, Rish Lakish's son, and he asked him, well, what did you learn? So he told him, again, a pasuk in Mishlei. The pasuk in Mishlei says, Iveles Adam tesalef darko. Iveles, foolishness. Sometimes a person's foolishness can ruin things for him. Ba'al Hashem yizaf libo. And he gets angry at Hashem. Now, sometimes a person ruins things for themselves. They didn't even need any help. They didn't even need any divine intervention. They did the whole thing by themselves. But their response is, why is Hashem doing this to me? What does that mean? Basically, what Shlomo HaMelech says, and what the Rambam discusses at length in the Mor Nevuchim, a person goes out throughout the winter without a coat, and then he catches a cold, so he shouldn't look heavenwards. As if to say, what's the message? The message is buy a coat and a scarf, and that's the message. So his foolishness, his irresponsibility, if he leaves without having left enough time to get to the airport and he misses the plane, so that's not Minas Shamayim. I mean, he is not Minas Shamayim, more correctly there. Leave enough time, and so it is with many things. That's what Shlomo HaMelech says. And Rabbi Yochanan states the following. Can it be, mi'ikam midi dechsivi, can there be something that's written in Ksuvim, v'lo remizi be'araisa, and not alluded to in the Torah? Again, we find this premise, this axiom, and it's even more explicitly stated as a rhetorical question. Can it be that it's a pasuk in Ksuvim and not in the Torah? It's got to be in the Torah. Where is it? So interestingly, his nephew provided the answer. His nephew, who was a young Torah scholar himself, so he pointed to a section in Chumash Bereishis where the brothers, they came down to Mitzrayim, and Yosef gave them their food, but he gave them their money back. And they're halfway home. One of them opens the bag to feed the animals, and then he sees the money, he discovers the money. The pasuk says, it's a chiddush, I think, what he's about to say, but the pasuk says, Vayesuliban, their hearts left them, Vayomru ma zos asa elokim lanu. What has God done to us? And Rabbi Yochanan's nephew says, well, he didn't do anything. Why didn't you check your bags before you left? That's normal practice. Didn't they seem heavier than usual or something? Well, that's standard. Check your bags. You didn't check your bags. So you're halfway home, and then you find the money, and you say, what's Hashem done to you? You should have exercised due diligence. So, of course, a full discussion is yet pending as to where the boundaries are. But this was Rish's answer. And again, there too, we learn more from the question than from the answer, because the answer is local, but the question is global. As if to say, we once again enunciate this principle. And indeed, again, the principle being that Nevi'im and Ksuvim, they serve to elaborate. They are the first commentary on the Torah, Nevi'im and Ksuvim. And it's for this reason, we've mentioned in the past, that Gemara says in Maseches Nedarim, on Daf Kach Beis, a rather startling statement, Ilmale Chotu Yisrael, had the Jewish people not sinned, the Cheta Egal, they would not have been given Nevi'im and Ksuvim. Only Chamisha Chumshei Torah. And Sefer Yoshua, because Sefer Yoshua tells everyone where to live. I mean, you can't work that out. But the rest of the Nevi'im and Ksuvim, they would not have been given. So this Gemara, of course, is very challenging, because it sounds like we didn't do too badly out of the Cheta Egal. We would have been deprived, in fact. What's our punishment for doing the Cheta Egel? Torah. Nevi'im Ksuvim. That doesn't seem to be, the punishment doesn't seem to fit the crime. It seems to be a reward. It almost sounds like had we not done the Cheta Egel, we would have missed out on all of those svarim. However, the Netziv, in his introduction to his parish on the Shiltas of Rabbi Haigon, the Netziv says, no, that's not the point. The point is, had we not sinned in the Chet HaEgel, we would not have missed out. We wouldn't have had Nevi'im Ksuvim, but we wouldn't have missed out, because we wouldn't have needed Nevi'im Ksuvim for their primary function, which is to uncover and elucidate and crystallize and formulate all the concepts that are in the Torah. We would have been on a level where we would have the clarity of vision and depth of perception to see those things for ourselves. Having fallen at the time of the Egel, we need the balance of Nevi'im Ksuvim in order to bring them out. So that is a very important discussion. And again, in terms of where we are, it comes from the question, Zeicher Tzadik Livracha, it's a pasuk in Mishlei, but where is it in the Torah? Well, where is it in the Torah after all that? Says the Gemara there in Yuma, if you look in Parshas Vayera, in Perek Yudches, it's around Sheni, Perek Yudches, Pasuk Yud Zayin, it states. So this is when the three guests, they've been to Avram, they're on the way to Sodom. Hashem's about to destroy Sodom. V'Hashem Amar, Hashem said, Hamachaseni me'Avraham, Asher ani Yoseh. Am I withholding from Avram information what I'm about to do with Sodom? And the next pasuk states, V'Avraham hayo yiyeh legoy gadol v'atzum. Avram will be a great and mighty nation. V'nivruchu bo kol goyei ha'aretz. All the nations of the world will be blessed through him. And says the Gemara in Yuma, what's one thing got to do with the other? You're talking about Avram, you're talking about telling him about Sodom, and then you start talking about what a great nation he'll be. That's not relevant. That's not moving in a straight line. What is that? Says the Gemara, Zeicher Tzadik Livracha. He mentioned the Tzadik gave him a bracha. And that's that. So what we see from the Gemara is that if you're looking for the source in the Torah for the idea of Zeicher Tzadik Livracha, you need look no further than Parshas Vayera. There's just one problem. I don't know if there's probably a more polite way to say it, but whoever said that in the Gemara, he didn't learn Rashi's Perush on the beginning of Parshas Noach. Because if he did, you don't need to get to Parshas Vayera as soon as you get to Noach. Eile told us Noach, Noach is Tzadik, Zeicher Tzadik Livracha. As a matter of principle, Chazal will always reveal to us an idea from the first available opportunity. They won't wait, they won't pass over. And wait, how come they passed over Noah and went to Avram? That is the question. Interestingly, and just for the sake of completion, Rashi mentions Zeicher Tzadik Livracha in both places. And what about the final part of the pasuk? V'shem Rishaim Yirkav, the name of the wicked will rot. Does that get any mention? It does, in between these two, in Parshas Lech Lecha, because it says that Lot decided he wanted to live in Sodom, and the pasuk says, "Ba'anshei Sodom ro'im v'chatoim l'shem o." The people of Sodom, they were big rishoyim. And Rashi says, well, how's that relevant yet? Maybe it isn't. But someone said Sodom, shame rishoyim yakav. You mean, you talk about a rasha, you've got to say what a rasha they are. So it's very interesting because we have a sandwiched between two instances of Zeicher Tzadik Livracha, you have their Shem Rishayim Yirkav. But back to our question, why is it that he would not adduce the first Rashi in Parshas Noach as his source in the Torah for Zeicher Tzadik Livracha? Well, the answer, if we come back to our Rashi, where Rashi gave two Pirushim, is presented in the Maskil Adot. One of the classic Mefarshe Rashi. And really, it will bring us to a most basic question that we're perhaps not expecting to ask. We say Zeicher Tzadik Livracha. We mentioned in the Tzadik is Livracha. What does Bracha mean? What is the meaning of the word Bracha? What's the meaning of the word Baruch? When we say Baruch Atah Hashem, what do we mean by that? What kind of word is it? What family of words does it belong? Who are its siblings? What are the synonyms for bracha? And here we find there seem to be two schools of thought. There are those who say that the word baruch is an expression of praise. It belongs to the family of shevach and hallel and bracha. Like the pasuk says in Tehillim, "Umaromam al bracha tehillah." Hashem is exalted beyond bracha and praise. Bracha and tehillah are similar words. That's one approach. However, there is another approach which many hold by. And famous amongst them is Reb Chaim Volozhin in his Sefer Nefesh HaChaim. And he states that the word bracha does not mean praise. It's not an expression of praise. Rather, and he's going to demonstrate that in just a moment, rather, says Reb Chaim, what the word bracha means is an expression of increase. Levarech is to increase. Now, why does he say that? And how does he know it? Says Reb Chaim, I'll prove it to you. There is a famous episode mentioned in the Gemara in Brachos and Daf Zayin. Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha, who was the Kohen Gadol. And Rabbi Shmuel, he tells the of the time that he was in the Lefnai v'Lefnim, in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, on Yom Kippur. And he has this encounter with Hashem. And V'omar li, says Rabbi Shmuel, V'omar li, he said to me, Yishmael b'ni barcheni. Yishmael, my son, bless me. Barcheni. Well, that's already a very unusual situation. But, says Rabbi Shmuel, Amarti lo, so I said to him, Yehi ratam ufanecha, may it be your will, sheyichbashu rachamecha es kascha, that your mercy shall suppress your anger, v'yogolu rachamecha midosecha, and your compassion shall roll over all your other midos, and you should act beyond the letter of the law with us, and v'bidas harachamim. I asked for rachamim for the Jewish people. That was my response. And then the Gemara says, v'lianea liberosho, and he nodded his head, Hashem, so to speak, in assent, in appreciation. Lelamedcha, says the Gemara, to teach you, sha'alti birchas hedyot kala be'inecha. Never take a normal person's bracha lightly, because the distance between them and you will never be greater than the distance between Rabbi Shmuel and Hashem. But Hashem had the courtesy and to nod in appreciation. So if someone gives you a bracha, don't brush them off. You also nod in appreciation. That's the source, by the way, for the stanza towards the end of the song Anam Zemiris, which is all based on the Kabbalah. It's from Chassidei Ashkenaz. Towards the end, Uvavirchasi Tanea Neali Rosh. For my bracha, you should nod your head. That's come straight from that Gemara over there with Rabbi Shmuel. The whole Anam Zemiris, the whole Shira Kabbalah, it's all laced with Kabbalah, and which is why the little children say it. From a certain point of view, it's safer. I mean, they don't even imagine they know what it means. So maybe maybe it's for the best. So says Reb Chaim, why have I mentioned that Gemara? Because if you look at that Gemara, you will see what the word bracha means. Or more correctly, you will see what it doesn't mean, which will then make room to see what it does mean. You see, if the word bracha means praise, if it's a synonym, a watchword for praise, then when Hashem says to Rabbi Shmuel, Barcheini, you can learn a lot about what the word bracha means by seeing how Rabbi Shmuel responded. You should watch that space. Because if it means praise, then he should have responded with praise. But he didn't. He responded with a request for increased rachamim, for increased patience, for increased compassion. That's Barcheini. And really, what that means is that Hashem's input into the world is significantly dependent upon the Jewish people themselves. So Hashem is saying to Rabbi Shmuel, it's up to you. And if you ask for it, you'll get it. And if you ask for more, you'll get more. And that's called Barcheini. That's what it means to increase, as if to say, to increase Hashem's input into the world. That's what it means to make a bracha. And therefore, says Reb Chaim, you see conclusively from that Gemara, that when he responded to bracha with the petition for increase, not with praise, that tells you bracha does not mean praise. It means increase. And case closed. That's that. Well, there are those, however, who do say that the word bracha means praise. What will they do with that Gemara? He didn't respond with praise. Well, perhaps he did. And the reason why I say that is based on a statement of the Gaonim, which relates to days that we have just come through, the Yom HaNarayim. We'd never imagine that's something that is for us as old as the hills. It's in every siddur, was originally contested and was point of great controversy. Namely, the first addition that we insert in the Yom Nerai, in the bracha of Magen Avraham. We say Zachreinu L'chaim. We ask Hashem to remember us for life. Now that doesn't sound too objectionable, but it is objectionable, seemingly, because the Gemara states in Brachos and Daf Lamed Daled that you can't ask for things in the first three Brachos. The first three Brachos need to be reserved only for praise. Al Yivakish Adam Tzrachov, Lo Begimel Rishonos, Velo Begimel Achronos. So leaving aside the final three, but the first three, you have 13 middle Brachos you can ask for whatever you want, and we don't wait. The first bracha, and it's not meant for asking for things, and we ask for things anyway. And it's for this reason that there were some Gaonim who were opposed to the practice of saying, Zachreinu L'chaim, you can't ask for things in the first bracha. But we do. It's in the Siddur, in the good Siddurim everywhere. But how can it be explained? Well, says the Tosfos, Rav Haigon defended the Minhag, explained the Minhag, and said, when the Gemara says you shouldn't ask for things in the first three brachas, that's an individual shouldn't ask for things. But for the tzibur, you can. Now, which will in the plural, it's for everyone. So again, Rav Haigon says, you know what's objectionable? For an individual to ask for something, for his own personal needs. But communal needs, national needs, that's acceptable. But the question is, why is it acceptable? This sounds like safety in numbers. Because if one person does it, it's wrong. But if everyone does it, it's okay. That's not normally true. It's worse. So why does it make it okay? But the Tosfos HaRosh explains, because when everyone asks for something, or when you ask for everyone, it has a different dynamic. It's actually a form of praise. Because the implicit message is, everyone needs you. That's a praise. That's the highest praise. Everyone is dependent on you. To say that I'm dependent on you, that's not praise. That's a nuisance. But that has a different dynamic. But to say everyone, Rabim Tzrichim Lo, everyone needs you, there's no greater praise. And thus, as the request goes from the singular to the plural, it changes from a request to a form of praise. So says the Tosfos HaRosh. Well, achar hadvarim ha'ele, based on that explanation, perhaps we may say that we can defend or the position that the word bracha really does is an expression of praise, and many say it. What about Reb Chaim's question that when Hashem said barcheini, he responded with a request, but it was a request for everyone. It's like zochreinu l'chaim. You should act with all of your children. The entire Jewish people need you. That's praise. And that's its own form of bracha. That is perhaps a suggestion that one may make. At any rate, what we have seen over the course of the last moments is that the question of what the word bracha means is debated among the Mefarshim. It's such a basic question. We say it 100 times a day. What do we mean when we say Baruch Atah Hashem? It means Hashem is praised, or we're looking to increase his input into the world. And where do we find this discussion? Amongst Mefarshim, Rishonim, Achronim. Says the Maskil of David, you can find it earlier than that. You can find this discussion in Chazal themselves. This very question is debated by Chazal themselves. Where? In Rashi, in the two explanations that Rashi brings. Because if we go back to the first Rashi, first comment, and that is, once again, to remind ourselves, Ela told us Noach, Noach is the tzaddik. It seems like we've interrupted to talk about him. We started talking about his children, then went to talk about him. How can we explain it? So Rashi says, you can explain it. There's a concept. It's an established concept. Zecher tzaddik l'vracha. Why here is another question. But Zecher tzaddik l'vracha. Says Maskil of David, that's a perfect answer. But it depends on one thing. How you understand the word bracha. Because what the Torah did is it digressed to speak in praise of Noach. Say what a tzaddik he was. This is all in the past. That's in praise. Is that a fulfillment of Zecher Tzaddik Levracha? Maybe. If the word bracha is an expression of praise, then to speak in praise is a fulfillment of Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And that is the side in Chazal that's represented by Rashi's first comment. But not everyone would agree with that. And the reason why they wouldn't agree with Rashi's first comment is because perhaps they have a different understanding of what the word bracha means. Maybe it doesn't mean praise. Maybe it means increase. And Noach wasn't increased. Talking in praise in the past tense, that doesn't increase anything. It's not an increase in Noach. And therefore, with all the goodwill in the world, and with all the Zecher Tzadik Livracha, it's an important principle, but it has no relevance here, because bracha means increase, not praise. So if it interrupted to speak in his praise, you can't explain it based on Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and that's where Rashi moved in recognition of that other understanding of the word Baruch, whereby Zecher Tzadik Rashi had to take recourse to the second explanation, which is maybe his good deeds are his toldos. There's no other way to explain it. It turns out, therefore, if we read, shall we say, between the lines, that between the two Pirushim of Rashi is really the beginnings of the discussion of what the word Baruch means. And we may add, as a PS, this is also will explain to us the position of that rabbi in the Gemara in Yuma, and Daf Lamed Ches, when he was asked what is the source of Zecher Tzadik Livracha, he skipped over Noah. He went straight to Avram. Why just skip over Noah? Because he opines that the word bracha means an increase, and therefore, if you speak in praise of Noah, that's not Zecher Tzadik Livracha. You know what's yes Zecher Tzadik Livracha? What Hashem said to Avram about Avram, because he mentioned him, and then he gave him a bracha, and he said, "He will be a great nation." That's an increase in Avram. That's the first time you find it in the Torah. Thus, between the Gemara and the Rashi, we see that this very basic question is what is behind the two Pirushim of Rashi. That is the explanation of the Maskil Adavah. Okay, moving on. Well, we have the situation as the Mabul begins. We haven't really gotten that far into the Parsha yet, but it's a terrible situation. As the Pasuk describes, Pasuk Yud Beis, the land is corrupt, the earth is corrupt. All of life, all of flesh has corrupted. But Rashi says, what does it mean? All of flesh. Everyone, everything. Even animals and beasts and birds were all intermating. It was a complete chaos. That's the situation as it was. Now, Noach is told to bring together, or more correctly, to collect two of each, as it says, Me'of, Pasuk Yutes, U'mikol Achai, Mikol Basar, Shnayim Mikol, two of each, Tavi Al Ateva Lachi Yositach. Zachar and a keva, a male and a female. Pasuk kaf me'of l'minehu. Where the birds, l'minehu, min abeimah l'mina, each animal species, mikol remes adamah l'minehu, they should all come to the teva. Shnai mikol yovo'u eilecha l'hachayos. Two by two, as we know. Rashi comments on the words me'of l'minehu. Rashi says, l'minehu, in their species, means those that stayed faithful to their species. Osan shedav could be mineim, velo ishchisu darkam, and were not as corrupt as the other animals. Because generally speaking, the animals were corrupt and they were intermating in other species, but there was always a couple that weren't. They're the ones. They're called liminehu. They're the ones that will come to the table. So the whole situation is very unusual. Both parts of the equation. It's difficult to understand how animals can start to become corrupted in that way. They don't seem to have the same moral issues or decision-making apparatus that people do. But somehow, everyone became corrupt. Okay, so be it. All the animals became corrupt. And then within every species, you have like these two animals that just... they stayed stark, and they resisted. Where did this come from? You have this chabura of these, two animals from each type of animal. So you've got Rishayim and Tzadikim. Who's the Rishayim? Who's the Tzadikim? How are there either of those things? And certainly not both of them. So if Gedalia Shor, that's how, explains that this is an extension of a concept or an idea that is discussed by the Beis Halevi. You know, Rashi has told us, and it's from the Medrash, that all the species were intermating, and there was corruption everywhere. You know, the Gemara says in Sanhedrin and Daf Kuf Ches that when Hashem says that he's going to destroy everything, so the Gemara says, well, why are you destroying everything? Okay, Mela, man, was, you know, acted incorrectly, but what about the animals and all of that, right? They didn't act incorrectly. So why are you destroying them? So as the Marshal points out, that doesn't seem to be in tandem with what we just said. And we just said that there was corruption everywhere. But the Gemara seems to say, no, man was corrupt, not everything else was fine. So which was it? Says the Beis Halevi, both. There was corruption everywhere, but only man deserved to be punished. That's the question of the Gemara. And the reason why is because an animal can't undergo moral decline. An animal can't become corrupt in that way, or more correctly, it cannot corrupt itself. However, the effect of deeds of human beings extends to their surroundings. And when, as a person ruins his own personal nature, he can corrupt the nature of everything around him. To what degree? Depends on the person, but to some degree, he can corrupt the nature of the world, as the Pasuk talks about. When it describes the Jewish people sinning, it says they defile the land. That means that they affect the land. They give it that quality. And they can affect the animals around them. They can affect people around them. They can instill a certain nature which makes it perhaps difficult, either more difficult or more easy for those around them. Because everyone has an animal in them, which means that if they can affect the animals generally, they can affect that side of a person. So no man is an island. And every person's deeds have consequences not only for their own nature, for better or for worse, but they have a sphere of influence. And they can be held accountable for it, even for other people's decisions, to some degree. To the extent, if you influence a person knowingly, for the worse, you're responsible to some degree. If you influence them for the better, you are eligible to some share in what they do. And in fact, the Beis Halevi says that is the concept of what we call din v'cheshbon. Din v'cheshbon, we always say a judgment and a reckoning, like it says in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. But what is din and what is cheshbon? What is the reckoning if not the judgment? It's the same thing, seemingly, but it's not the same thing. Din is a person's judgment for what they do or didn't do. But then there's the cheshbon, and the cheshbon is, it's literally a calculation. What are the effects of what they did? And that could be, have spilled over into other people's deeds. That's beyond din. That's the cheshbon. It's a very, very important yisod. And therefore, says the Beis Halevi, this explains to us how it could be that even the nature of animals had been corrupted. They were not corrupt, but they became corrupted because they occupied the same world as human beings. When human beings corrupted their own nature, they corrupted the nature of everything. And that's why, on the one hand, you had all of this chaos, but the Gemara still says, but the animals don't need to be punished because they didn't do anything wrong. They didn't sin. And that's what's behind the decline in the nature of everything in the world. But the only question then is, so then how is it that you have two of each species, which was our opening question, where does that come from? If the nature of animals changes, that's the nature of the beast, and that's the end of it. How do they have the fortitude to resist? They don't have that moral aspect of them. It says the Or Gedaliahu, most fascinating. It could be that the reason why there was a sample or representation, minimal, albeit, of every type of species that stayed faithful to their species is because there was a representation amongst humankind of those that stayed faithful. And that's Noah and those members of his family. As if to say, if the world generally was in a state of moral decline, which led, if humankind led to the nature of the world, but there was that enclave within humankind called Noah and his family. And they stayed firm, and they did not decline. And therefore, in a sense, what you can see is their effect. They enabled a representation of every other type of living being also not to decline. So in a very fascinating sense, these were Noah's animals that came to him. If you ever wonder which animals do you affect and which, now you know. Because if you're the only one who's stayed morally correct, and these are the only animals that have, likewise, those are his animals. And they gravitated towards him. That's a truly thought-provoking idea from the Orgue d'Alliance. Well, our relationship with Noah is somewhat remote, somewhat detached. We don't associate ourselves with him so much. We talk about people who are non-Jewish as B'nai Noah. That's a good thing to call them. But we're not B'nai Noah. We take off from Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, and there's no looking back. When we talk about Avos, as the Gemara says in Brachos and Daf Tesvav, Tetzayin, Ein Koren L'Avos Ela L'Shlosha. We only call three people Avos. We don't go further back then. Not Noah and not Adam. Okay. Which means that when we daven and we reference our ancestors, our forebears, it will always be Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, and not Noah. But there's one exception. There is one time where we do mention Noah in the davening. And once again, it's quite recently. It's in Musaf of Rosh Hashanah. And it's in the Zerach of Zichronos. And there we say, Kizecha kol amasim nefanecha ba, the remembrance of all deeds or of all creatures comes before you. Vatada resh maaseh kulam, you seek out and the measure of all of them. The Gamis Noach ba'ava zachartan. You remember Noach, the first personality that we mention as an example of Zichronos is Noach, of all people. But if Kedeu b'dvashu b'rachamim, and you took account of him in a matter of salvation and mercy, ba'viachas mehamabul l'shacheis kol basar b'pnei mura malaleim. You brought the mabul to destroy everyone else because of their bad deeds. Al kein zichrono balefanecha. Therefore, his remembrance came before you, as it says, "Vayizkor lekim es Noah," from this week's parsha. So that's very interesting. Of all the times to forge an association with Noah, we choose Rosh Hashanah. Generally, throughout the year, well, you'll never hear of him in the Siddur, and Rosh Hashanah, that most sensitive time. We start with Noah. It's also interesting if we're medactic, as we should be, in the nusach of the tefillah. Because again, the words are, you remembered Noah, b'divai Yeshua b'rachamim, matter of salvation and compassion. V'aviachas me'a mabul, when you brought the mabul, l'shacheis kol basar, to destroy all flesh as a result of their bad deeds. Al kein zichrono balefanecha. Therefore, his remembrance came before you. Now, we might not think about this during Musaf because we're wrapped up in other things. But if whenever you see the expression al kein, it sounds like what you're about to say is a product of what you just said. But where's the therefore? We say that Hashem brought the marble. Therefore, you remembered Noah. That's not a therefore. You could say you remembered him because he's a tzaddik. In other words, what is it that would precipitate? What is it that would lead Hashem, so to speak, to remember Noah? Not the fact that he brought the Mabul. What leads you to remember Noah? Something about Noah. But we don't say that. We say everyone was so corrupt. Therefore, you remember Noah. How does A lead to B? That's the question. And this question is discussed in the Perush of the Torah Tamima to the Siddur, which is called Baruch Sha'amar. And he explains. There's a well-known discussion, again, back to the beginning of Parshas Noah. What to make of Noah. It's in the Gemara and in the Medrash, and Rashi quotes it. Because the Gemara, the pasuk says that Noach was ish tzaddik tamim b'darosa. He was the perfect tzaddik in his generations. And the question is that meant to even increase our appreciation of Noach, or perhaps to modify it? Yesh darshin l'shvach, yesh darshin l'knai. Some say it means only to propel Noach and to promote him even more, even in his generation. Kal v'chomer, one can only imagine in a generation of tzaddikim. And others say no. The point is that relative to his generation, it's an amazing thing. We wouldn't expect that type of maybe approach. The pasuk really does seem to talk glowingly about Noah. And don't forget his korbanos in their merit. There's never going to be a flood again. By Yarach Hashem, it's Reach HaNichoah. So there's no doubting in a sense Noah's credential. And yet there are those who are Dorish Lignai, and what it means is relative to the people in his generation, he was a tzaddik. But, you know, in a generation of tzaddikim, he wouldn't have stood out. Wow. Says the Baruch Sha'amar, says the Torah Tamima, it seems that whoever composed the bracha of Zichronos and Rosh Hashanah actually sides with those who were Dorish Lignai, who explained that pasuk as reflecting, as qualifying it, as somewhat negatively about Noach. In other words, what made him to be considered to be a tzaddik? He was only a tzaddik, again, easy for us to talk, but we've got to learn the Torah. He was only a tzaddik relative to the people's generation. What that means is that in order for Hashem to look upon Noach as a tzaddik, he first needed to look upon the rest of his generation, and then by comparison, Noach emerges as a tzaddik. And that's why the pasuk says everyone else was so corrupt, and you brought a mabul al kain. Therefore, that itself is what brought Noach to zichron b'alafanecha, because it's with such reshoyim and relative to them, he remained a tzaddik. But you need them in the picture in order to define him as a tzaddik. That's called al kain because of them. Al kain zichron b'alafanecha. But that's why it's called divai Yeshua v'rachamim, salvation. It's mercy. It was an act of compassion. Why is it an act of compassion? Because it's defining Noach as a tzaddik within context, relative to his generation. Well, the question nonetheless remains, why do we say this? So subsequent Mefarshim explain that there's an implicit idea here in this tefillah. Because Rosh Hashanah, of all days, to talk about Noah and the flood, Rosh Hashanah is a day of dinner about the Jewish people. And as we mentioned recently, it's specifically the Jewish people vis-a-vis the other nations of the world. I mean, do they deserve their status? The Jewish people are not always in such great shape. But relative to the nations of the world, they'll always emerge as tzaddikim. In other words, therefore, what we're saying is, as part of the Brach of Zichronos, we're asking Hashem to relate to us, perhaps in the way that he was kind enough to relate to Noah. If Noah was not a tzaddik, according to those who were Dorish Lignai, you had to compare him with everybody else in order to make him a tzaddik. But it worked! But if Gedehu, b'dvar Yeshua v'rachamim, so we ask Hashem to do the same for us. Because wherever we are, it will always be head and shoulders above where everybody else is. And that Yisrael or Lefi Hador, we're asking Hashem to relate to us in that Noah type of way. Well, the final section, or penultimate section actually, of Noah is about Migdal Bavel. And again, it's rather opaque. The Torah's account of what happened, they want to build a tower, and it wasn't a good thing, and it could only even lead to worse things, and Hashem dispersed them, and as the Pasuk describes in Perek Yud Aleph, so the first 9 psukim are about Migdal Bavel, Tower of Bavel. Pasuk Ches says, "Vayachet Hashem osam mi'al poch kopnei haaretz." Hashem dispersed them. They couldn't hear each other. Vayachtalu l'bnei Seir. They stopped building the city. Obviously, they weren't there anymore. Al kein karshma bavel. That's why the place is called Bavel. Kisham balal Hashem svas kol haaretz. That's where Hashem mixed up the language of the whole world. All the world's population was there at that time. Umisham hefitzam Hashem, and from there Hashem dispersed them apnei kol haaretz, over the face of the world. That's the end of the parsha. So what they received was a punishment of sorts, because what they were doing or what they would have done was quite reprehensible, and therefore they got this punishment. Rabbeinu Bachya has a very interesting comment. As we know, the Torah transmits on many wavelengths. Pshat, Remez, Drash, Sod. The name of Hashem, Yudke Vavke, is a name of Rachamim. It represents the Midah of mercy, of compassion. And sometimes you find that the name of Yudke Vavke is alluded to in Rosh Tevas, Yismuch HaShamayim, Besoget HaAretz. And that also has that very benevolent and compassionate atmosphere about it. The Remez through the Rosh Tevas. Sometimes, says Rabbeinu Bachya, you will find the name of Yud Kei Vav Kei alluded to backwards. And when it's alluded to backwards, in reverse, it reflects the reverse of Midas HaRachem, which is Midas HaDin. And the classic example, or the easiest example to reference, is actually from Megillas Esther. Because the beginning of Haman's downfall is when it was just not enough for him, and he had to keep on going. He's on top of the world, but there's that one person who doesn't bow down to him, that one Jew, Mordechai. He's got everything, but it's not enough. V'chol zeh einenu shoveli. It's not enough for me, and he had to keep on going. He rushed headlong to his downfall. V'chol eis asher neres Mordechai yudi yashir b'shar ha-melech. Says Rabbeinu Bachya, again, his words are v'chol, as we know, v'chol zeh einenu shoveli. Look at the sofei tevos. Ze einenu shove li. Hey, vav, hey, yud. That's the Shem Hashem. But it's backwards, because this is where Midas HaDin begins to get to and to act, to be meted out against Haman. And another example, Pasuk. Because if you look again, you'll see, Alkein, Pasuk Tes, Karoshma Bovel, Kobovel, Kisham Balal Hashem, Esfas Kol Ha'aretz Umisham Hefitzam Hashem. If you look at the words Ha'aretz Umisham Hefitzam Hashem, the Rosh Tevas, Hey Vav Hey Yud. And that reflects the Midas HaDin through which they were punished and dispersed and scattered and so on and so forth. So says Rabbeinu Bachya. And this is a concept that he talks about, I think, at least six times in the course of his parish. But here is a unique situation. And the reason why, we cannot help but note, and Rashi himself comments, that as much as the door, what's called the door HaPaloga, the generation of the Tower of Babel, as much as they were punished, but their punishment was relatively mild when compared with the door HaMabul in the beginning of Noah. You cannot help but see those two together. And the door HaMabul, they were completely wiped out. And the door HaPaloga, they were dispersed, but they're okay wherever they are. They're just not together. They don't understand each other. It's relatively mild. And Rashi explains that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, was more makbid on the kovod of humankind than he was on his own kovod. That's the difference between the two generations. The flaw of the generation of the Mabul was they were destroying each other. There was chamas, there was violence. And Hashem did not tolerate that. And they absolutely met their end, with the exception of Noah. In contrast, and for what it's worth, the generation of the Dor HaPlaga, they were unified. Sofa Achas, Dor Machadim, they were together, they wanted to stay together. Perhaps in an unhealthy way, in a way certainly that would lead them away from Hashem, they sought to substitute themselves. So there's no question that their infraction was in the category of Ben Adam Lamokom. This tower, it's a symbol, they're rebelling, they don't need him, look how much they can do. In fact, it's very interesting to note two things about this tower. They want to make the tower as tall as possible. What do we know about what they did? Firstly, where they were, and secondly, the way they went about it. The Pasuk describes, in Pasuk Zion, Gimel, Vayomer Ishal Re'ehu, Havanir Ben Aleveinu, let's make bricks, V'nisuf Al Esreifa, and put them in the furnace, in the kiln, and they used bricks instead of stones. Okay, bricks instead of stone. That's a rather particular detail. They used bricks instead of stone. I guess either would do, but they want a BRICS. Why is it so important? It's also very interesting that where are they making this tower? The Pasuk says, Pasuk Beis, Vayibin Asa Mikedem, as they moved eastward, or some say from Hashem, Kadmona Shel Ola, Vayimtu Biko Be'eretz Shina Vayesh Misham. They found a valley, because a valley. So now, if you want to make a very, very tall tower, and you want to be as tall as it could be, so here's an idea. Why don't you start on a mountain? And then you get a head start. Nature's own. You're almost like you're giving yourself a much more difficult task by starting in the valley. You've got a lot to compensate for. And then by the time you get to the mountain, you know, that it could be 2 months and you could have just started there. So I must say, I had a very interesting idea. It was from my son, actually, my second son, Ari, the Shabbos table last year. He said that's part of their rebellion. They want to show Hashem that they don't need him. You can't rebel against him, but then thank him for the mountain. It's, on the contrary, they want to show that they don't even need his mountains. We'll take it. We'll start from a low point, and we're still going to get to the heavens. And that's why the Pasuk emphasizes that they made bricks and not stones. What's the difference between a brick and a stone? A stone is nature's own. A stone is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave it. A brick we made ourselves. And the stuff of which the tower will be made is the stuff of which the rebellion is shed. Even though it was principled to the point of stupidity, because you're not going to use his rocks. You're going to use your own bricks, made from the dirt that he gave you. You're not going to start on a mountain. You'll start on you're standing on his earth. But, you know, you can't, well, those were their principles. There's only so far they could go. They can't refuse to use anything from Hashem, because otherwise they'll never be able to rebel against him. But they keep it to a minimum. I mean, it reminds us of a BDS, right? People who refuse to use anything from Israel, and they use Israeli technology in order to reestablish their refusal. They can't. They wouldn't be able to. They wouldn't get off the ground. Nebuch, what can they do? That's Migdal Babel. So it was an out-and-out rebellion. It was a Dafkanik type of rebellion. We're definitely going to use bricks. That takes a lot of, you know, there's rocks there. No, not using rocks. And we're definitely going to start at a low point. You've got a mountain there. No, fine. So in Ben Adam La Mokom, it was a disaster. But some have Ben Adam La Chaveiro there, again, in a very non-kosher way. But they had this unity. And in recognition of that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not destroy them in the way he destroyed the Mabel, the generation of the Mabel. And where do we see it, says Rabbi Bachya? We mentioned that the Shem Hashem, when it's alluded to backwards, refers to Midas Hadin. And when it's forwards, it's Midas HaRachamim. So now the question is, well, the how did Hashem relate to this generation? Was Midas Hadin or Midas HaRachamim? We've seen Shem Hashem backwards. That's Midas Hadin. But look at the words, says Rabbi Bachya. Balal Hashem Svas Kol Aretz Umisham Hepitzam Hashem. That's where you find Shem Hashem backwards. Haaretz Umisham Hepitzam Hashem. Hey Vav Hey Yud. Right? That's the Shem Hashem backwards. But then that Yud at the end is actually the beginning of a Shem Hashem forwards. That Yud is the beginning of Yud Kei Vavke. So in other words, you have this merging, whereby on the one hand it is Midas Adin because they need to be punished. But you see, as much as it was punished, there was an admixture there. It was almost like Midas Hadin led into Midas HaRachamim, and that's where you got the final formulation, because they were punished, but nowhere nearly as bad as the Dor HaMabul, for reasons that the Mefarshim explained. We'll leave it over there for this evening.
We have a minion, gentlemen.